America's newest Marines are making history as the first group of women to complete training in San Diego earned that title. Do you know someone who is hesitant to get the COVID-19 vaccine? Misinformation is running rampant, especially in Spanish-speaking communities. And how the pandemic isn't slowing down the massive cross-border medical tourism market. I'm Maya Trabulsi, and the KPBS Roundtable starts now. Welcome to our discussion of the week's top stories. I'm Maya Trabulsi, and joining me on this remote edition of the KPBS Roundtable are Alex Nguyen, North County multimedia producer for KPBS News, reporter and author Jean Guerrero, and port of entry writer and producer Kinsey Moreland. For a century, new Marines have started their service at San Diego's Marine Corps Recruit Depot, but until this year, none of them were women. On Thursday, history was made as the first female platoon graduated from basic training, a grueling 12 weeks that pushes recruits to their physical and mental limits. KPBS North County multimedia producer Alexander Nguyen is following the group and joins us for an update. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Maya. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. So history was made this week. You attended Thursday's graduation event at MCRD, which naturally drew a lot of media attention. What was the atmosphere like, and how did it reflect on the significance of the event?
Well, the atmosphere at the graduation is a bit, you could tell there was a poignant and people realized the significance of it, but and also at the same time, it's a bit subdued because of COVID. So each graduate only gets to invite two family members or two person to be there. So it wasn't the raucous event that it used to be where you have lots of families, lots of friends and families. At the end, they come and rush to graduate and give them hugs. You just have two family members. So there is that sense where, yeah, this is a milestone, but it's also subdued because of COVID.
So 60 recruits were there at the beginning of basic training. How many actually made it to the end?
Well, 53 made it to the end, and it's about the same attrition rate as the men. So at any time during basic training, the Marines Corps said about 15% of the recruits got dropped from the program. And so 53 women made it through. That's exactly about the same amount that the men got dropped, about 15% or so. But as the drill instructors tell me that, you know, these group of women are really motivated. So some of the women who got dropped was due to other circumstances beyond their control. Like one woman was badly injured in a freak accident. And so she's recuperating and she is, she wants to start her training at Paris Island, where the next round of women recruits will be trained at. So you get a sense that these women, even though they got dropped from the program, they really, really are motivated to want to become Marines.
So can you give us an idea of how long and how arduous this process is and what some of the most challenging aspects of the training would be?
Well, the Marine Corps basic training boot camp is one of the toughest of all the military branches. But the most challenging aspect of this training, I would say, is what's known as the crucible, which is the end training, the culmination of the 13 weeks or so that they're trained. So they go through this whole entire event that's about 60 hours, 3 days or so, where they go through drills, they go through marches, and they were provided only two meals and about 6 hours of sleep, and they have to make it through. And at the end of that grueling process, they have to climb this hill that's called the Reaper on Camp Pendleton. That's the highest point in Camp Pendleton. And I was there that day, and when the recruits made it through the top, you could sense that there was that sound of relief, like, I don't have to climb any more hills. I've made it. And they train as platoon, they train as one unit. So they got pushed forward by other members of their unit to try to make to the top. So I've seen recruits linking arms, recruits just helping each other up that hill.
And is this the same exact training as the male recruits would be in?
Yeah, it's the same crew. So there are five platoons total, one platoon of female recruits and four platoons of male recruits, and they go through the exact same training, you know, and they oftentimes train together on the same elements.
Alex, so we covered the story on all of our platforms, TV, radio, and web, and your primary focus as a multimedia producer is digital. How did you try to tell this story differently for our online audience?
Well, we try to bring the audience through the process. So we cover them from the beginning when they were under quarantine at a hotel in San Diego, all the way through graduation. So we brought the readers, you know, along the way by through photos and through what we in the business call NAT packages, which are, you know, videos without narration to show what the process is like.
The Marines offered rare access to the boot camp at MCRD and Camp Pendleton. Why do you think they were eager to essentially pull the curtain back and show this experience that these women are going through?
So it just to show that women belong here in San Diego in training with the men, because right now the only place where women can be trained to become Marines is at Parris Island in South Carolina. And so this is seen as a test case for training here in San Diego. And, you know, off the record, these Marine officials tell me that this is proven to be a successful case for them. It shows that, you know, women can be trained alongside men here in San Diego. And I think that's part of the reason why the Marines Corps granted unprecedented access, just so that they could say, you know, it's been well documented that nothing was changed for these women. They did the same thing as the men and they succeeded.
Along the way, KPBS interviewed female drill instructors. Was this a new experience for them as well?
Yes. So they brought over one senior female instructor from Parris Island to oversee the process, and they graduated about four or so new drill instructors for this program. So for them, this is their first class of recruits that they trained.
What did the drill instructor say about the microscope the recruits are under, not only because of the training, of course, but because of the media attention? Did you get a sense that this was either a distraction or maybe it was more motivating?
Well, I think it's more motivating because one of the drill instructors said that, yes, these women understand they are under the microscope. And I think it gives them more motivation to prove the world wrong, especially since there was, Fox News, Tucker Carlson made some disparaging remarks about these women. And while they're at boot camp, they don't have access to the outside world, but, you know, they do know what's going on. So it actually gives them more motivation, I think, to be better and to do better than they were expected to do. And it shows because these women, they won their final drills, several performance reviews along the way, they placed first. So it shows that they were actually more motivated to prove the world wrong.
So what is next for this group? And will MCRD welcome another female class anytime soon? What are the plans?
So the plans now for all the graduates is that they go to infantry training at Camp Pendleton. And that's true for any graduate, Marine Corps graduate at MCRD. The next step is the infantry school. But usually they have about 10 days of leave to hang out with their families, to catch up with friends. But because of COVID, they are moving straight on to the next step of their training. But another female class is not planned anytime soon for MCRD here in San Diego. And we don't know when the next class will be, but the Marine Corps has until about 2028 to fully integrate training here in San Diego.
Well, thank you for following this story. I've been speaking with Alexander Nguyen, North County multimedia producer for KPBS News. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Maya.
California's vaccine rollout is among the best in the country when it comes to keeping COVID-19 cases under control. And we're about a month away from the tier system ending entirely. But when looking at the bigger picture, there are some troubling signs ahead. The New York Times reported this week that herd immunity is unlikely to be reached in the U.S., and that's according to health experts who cite lingering hesitancy. Some of that can be found in Spanish-speaking audiences, where some of the safeguards against misinformation are not quite as strong. Reporter and author Jean Guerrero wrote about this in an op-ed for the L.A. Times, and she returns to the roundtable. Hi, Jean.
Hey, Maya.
Gene, your piece starts with your father telling you about a video that he found on YouTube that has since been removed. What was the message and what was your reaction when you heard about it?
So this was at the beginning of the pandemic when the gravity of everything was sort of sinking in for everybody. And this video that my dad sent was from this chiropractor who has an office in Huntington Beach and an office in Tijuana named John Bergman, who was claiming that media coverage about the pandemic was, quote, designed to take away your rights. And he encouraged his viewers not to listen to any of it and to use hot water and vitamin C to kill the virus. He said that both drinking hot water and taking vitamin C would kill it. And so obviously when I watched this video, I was really worried about my dad, and I called him and told him, you know, I hope you're taking social distancing seriously. I hope you're wearing a mask. And he just became upset and he said that I was brainwashed. He'd sort of made up his mind already about the pandemic. And it just made me really frightened for him. As someone who has, you know, some pre-existing health issues, but also just in general, like the fact that this misinformation has been spreading and preying on vulnerable people like my dad. And it just made me angry at these people, these swindlers who prey on people like my dad.
Well, that particular video was removed off of YouTube, but not before it had more than 8 million hits. But this isn't just about your father. In your op-ed, there are several examples of family members coming across misinformation on social media. Are you surprised by how widespread this has taken root in the community?
You know, more than surprised, I was disturbed. Like, I mean, my grandmother, who's also an immigrant from Mexico, she also shared this Spanish language video saying that the virus had been invented by Big Pharma for profit, and she was worried about getting the vaccine because she thought that people were experimenting on us. But I wasn't entirely surprised because of the historical context. You know, between the 1930s and 1970s, a full third of Puerto Rico's female population was sterilized, and thousands of Mexicans and Latinos living in California were also sterilized. So there's this history of experimentation and inhumane medical policies and medical practices on the Latino community in the United States, which has made Latinos very skeptical. So I wasn't very surprised to see that my family was, you know, falling prey to this misinformation and fearing about being used as quote unquote guinea pigs or quote unquote being experimented on because of the historical context. But then, you know, I did some digging. I found, you know, that they're the same people who have been targeting Latinos with misinformation leading up to the election to try to depress Latino voter turnout are some of the same people who are disseminating this vaccine disinformation. The idea that the vaccine it has a microchip that's going to track you, the idea that it alters your DNA or that it causes stillbirths, these conspiracies that are spreading on social media and then through word of mouth, largely in the Latino community. And it's just incredibly dangerous because of the fact that Latinos are already more than two times more likely to die from the coronavirus than white people. They have among the worst outcomes of all of the ethnic groups.
Where are some other places this content is circulating?
So Facebook is the primary social media platform where these algorithms are targeting Latino communities, but it's also happening on YouTube and it's happening largely on WhatsApp because of the fact that so many Latinos use WhatsApp to text back and forth with one another, but also with family members back in Mexico and South America and other parts of Latin America, which allows these conspiracy theories that are incredibly dangerous to spread internationally. So some of the research groups that have been looking into this have found that there are both domestic actors who are spreading this misinformation, and there's also foreign actors. And because of the prevalent use of WhatsApp in Latinx communities, it creates a unique vulnerability.
What are some of the safeguards when it comes to moderating online content in other languages, such as Spanish? And how does it fall short compared to English content, for example?
So Facebook has been increasingly cracking down on misinformation in English, but there's still this sort of content moderation gap for Spanish language. One analysis found that after the 2020 election, Facebook put warnings on half of English language misinformation posts, but only on 10% of Spanish language misinformation. So they don't have enough content moderators who are making sure that Spanish language misinformation is not going out to vulnerable Latino communities. And that is reflected in the fact that now, you know, more than half of Latinos who have not yet been vaccinated either don't plan to or are hesitant to get vaccinated, in part because of this misinformation. And for Spanish dominant speakers, it's even bigger. It's at 67% that don't want to get vaccinated.
Jean, your story was a personal one, but there are many people who can relate to it. And we know that hesitancy crosses all cultures to some degree. What are some of the resources that are out there for people in the same situation of trying to talk to their family members who also fall for misinformation online?
So the good news is there are a lot of resources that are very helpful. I found PEN America's Media Literacy Guide, which is in both Spanish and English, very helpful. It's for teaching yourself and for teaching others how to identify fake news and to have a better understanding of separating trustworthy news from non-trustworthy news. They also have a guide that you can find online for speaking to family members who've been targeted. You can Google how to talk to friends and family who share misinformation and PEN America. And they have that guide in Spanish and English. But, you know, the number one thing that they advise is to approach family members with empathy. You know, we panic. We really want our family members to be safe and to take care of themselves. And so we might not approach with empathy and with calm and with understanding. And we really need to understand the historical context, the reason that Latinos hesitate and that many Latinos are skeptical, and the fact that they are prey, that they're being preyed on by misinformation peddlers. It's also important to identify basic barriers to people getting vaccinated. One thing that has been effective is if you offer your loved one a ride to their, and if you make an appointment to get the vaccine for them, often that will sway people who are on the fence to go out and protect themselves.
That's some great information. I've been speaking with Jean Guerrero, investigative reporter and author of Crux, a cross-border memoir. Thank you, Jean.
Thanks, Maya.
The San Ysidro border crossing is one of the busiest in the world, and a big part of that is due to the high cost of healthcare in the United States. The pandemic is doing little to slow the demand for prescription drugs, cancer treatments, dental work, and cosmetic surgery, all of which are cheaper and more accessible in Tijuana. Every person making the trip has a story to tell, and that is the focus of Port of Entry's latest podcast series on the booming medical tourism market. Our guest is Kinsey Moreland, producer and writer for Port of Entry. Hi, Kinsey.
Hey, Maya. Thanks so much for having me today.
Producing a series of podcasts focusing on one subject obviously allows you incredible breadth in the directions that you want to explore. Why did your team decide this was an important subject to focus on so deeply on a series of shows?
Well, our show focuses on cross-border people and cross-border lives, and medical tourism is just such a huge, huge and visible part of that. So right now, if you go to the border, and people who are familiar with sitting in that line, right, crossing back from Tijuana to San Diego, you see billboards everywhere for cosmetic surgery, for dental work, for all kinds of medical procedures. And of course, when you're crossing in from San Diego to Tijuana, some of the first things you'll see are the farmacias, the pharmacies. So it's just such a huge, huge part of our cross-border, it's a subculture of the cross-border community here. So we wanted to zero in and really focus on the personal stories of these people who are behind this incredible boom, because the industry is just booming.
And of course, there are so many personal stories to explore. But the first episode focuses on a woman named Maria, and she's from Otay Mesa. She's dealing with a second breast cancer diagnosis. What did you find so compelling about her story?
Well, first of all, she is brave and she's bold and she's interesting and she was willing to share her story with us. And I think what interested me personally about the story was that she crosses the border for alternative cancer treatment in Tijuana. And that, just saying that, makes me nervous. Like, oh my gosh, that, like, you're playing with your life here. But what she did for us was sort of lift the curtain into why she made that decision. So because this is her second go with cancer, she did do all the traditional stuff the first time around. And this time she just didn't want to do the chemo and the radiation. She did some of the other traditional treatments, but she invited us to her cancer group. And we just wanted to know more about her as a person and why she made this kind of incredible decision to cross the border to get, you know, kind of some unproven treatments in Tijuana. So I think she did a really good job of opening up her heart and her mind and really sharing her personal story with us.
And it's not just life-saving medical care that's drawing people to Mexico. Vanity also has a market there, especially in the era of Zoom meetings where we're all, our faces are on full display. So what is the demand for things like dental and cosmetic work during these times?
Right. So there's this fun term in the media. They're calling it the Zoom boom. So there's a lot of people, you know, in real meetings, in real life, we're not staring at ourselves, right? There's no mirror. But in Zoom meetings, we are looking at ourselves. And so that has caused some people to say, oh, wow, look at that nose of mine. I really got to get that fixed. But even more so than that, I actually talked to a recovery house in Tijuana that's a place where people, mostly women, go after cosmetic surgery to recover before they cross back to the U.S. And she said what she's hearing from clients is that they have time, right? They're staying at home. So you get these cosmetic surgeries and you get really bruised and you have stitches. And you can look really, really in bad shape for those first few weeks. So the fact that a lot of people are now working from home and not seeing their coworkers or could hide, you know, the below the face stuff that they, the work that they got done. She said that has been behind this just incredible drive for demands, particularly for cosmetic surgery, but dentist services really never slowed down either.
So much of the coverage surrounding the border has to do with politics and with immigration. So how important is it for podcasts like Port of Entry to show the larger picture of cross-border life?
Right. So obviously, politics and immigration are front and center when people think about the U.S.-Mexico border. And we don't shy away from those stories. We certainly have past episodes where we talk about immigration, where we talk specifically about politics. But it was important to us as people who live by border lives. You know, our host lives in Tijuana and San Diego. He's in a band. He has members on both sides of the border. So, you know, we know specifically that there is so much more to the border. And yes, there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of struggle, particularly when it comes to, you know, family separation and immigration and refugees and asylum seekers. But there's also a lot of vibrancy and a lot of artists who, you know, draw their inspiration from both sides of the border. There's a lot of these various subcultures and worlds that involve both sides of the border. And we work hard to sort of shine a light on all of the different subcultures that exist in the border region.
And the first episode of this latest Port of Entry series is available now, and I invite everyone to listen to it. When can we expect episode 2 in the series, and what can we look forward to in that episode?
Episode 2 drops on Wednesday, and we are following two women on their cross-border journeys to find more affordable insulin. The pandemic has sort of added an extra set of challenges, particularly for people with diabetes. So, you know, we kind of juxtapose two stories, right? A woman who is privileged enough to be able to afford the expensive insulin if she wanted to, but she sort of refuses to because it feels unjust. It feels not right to pay big pharma lots of money for a drug that her son needs to live. So we follow her journey. And then we talk to a grandma from Chula Vista who didn't have insurance, couldn't afford, has rationed. Yeah, it's just an interesting dynamic look at people who cross the border for life-saving drugs.
And Kinsey, you have a special line for people to call who can share their stories about medical tourism. And I imagine you must be getting some very interesting feedback on this specific topic as well. Can you share some of those with us?
Yeah, of course. So it's 619-452-0228. And you can either call or you can text. So far, the feedback we've been getting, I've heard from a lot of cancer survivors who, you know, some are very skeptical and say, oh man, I wish you wouldn't have spent so much money on all that stuff. But also, one in particular, I'm thinking, you know, said that, but then said, but I also shared this episode with all of my cancer survivor friends. Because again, I think this just like opens the curtain to what it's like to go through this process of struggling with cancer and that diagnosis and making decisions about how you're going to treat it. So I think that's been an interesting discussion.
And Port of Entry is available on all major podcast platforms. You can also stream it on the KPBS YouTube page and at kpbs.org. Kinsey Moreland is the show's writer and producer. Kinsey, thank you so much for joining me.
Maya, you're the best. Thank you.
That wraps up this week's edition of the KPBS Roundtable. I'd like to thank my guests, Alexander Nguyen from KPBS News, reporter and author Jean Guerrero, and Kinsey Moreland from Port of Entry. If you missed any part of our show, you can listen anytime on the KPBS Roundtable podcast. I'm Maya Tribulsi. Thanks for listening, and join us next week on the Roundtable.